This is a download from the BBC. To find out more and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts. The media show is presented by Steve Hewlett.
Hello, this is what we got on Monday after a long night of frenzied political negotiation. FT editor Lionel Barber called it a horse trader's ball.
Mr. Speaker, my right honourable friend, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition and I have today reached cross-party agreement on a royal charter that will help deliver a new system of independent and robust press regulation in our country.
Otherwise known as the Draft Royal Charter on Self-Regulation of the Press, or Clampdown on Free Press if you're the Sun, A Grubby Deal, the Telegraph, Revenge of the Politicians, the Mirror, or Shambles over at the Daily Mail. But as the dust starts to settle and all parties get down to studying the devilish detail, is this the beginning of the end of the Leveson debate on press regulation, or, and apologies for the cliché I'm sure you can hear coming, is it just the end of the beginning? Later we'll hear from Professor Natalie Fenton of Goldsmiths College and board member of campaign group Hacked Off, Chris Blackhurst, editor of The Independent, Peter Preston, veteran editor of The Guardian, now Observer columnist, and Times chief leader writer Philip Collins, who described the whole affair as bleak for press freedom. And if you want to join the debate, it's hashtag R4 Media Show if you use Twitter, or by all means email us via the Radio 4 website. But first, to the chair of the Media Standards Trust that campaigns on press reform and gave birth to the very prominent campaign group Hacked Off, Baroness Helena Kennedy QC. I spoke to her a little earlier this afternoon and started by asking what she makes of the proposal which the politicians agreed in those late-night, early-morning talks.
I was never someone who was very enthusiastic about the Royal Charter, but it seems to have got some purchase, and it certainly has meant that we've managed to get some kind of consensus as between all of the parties. And so I think that at least it moves this whole issue into a place where something solid might come out of it.
The Times editorial described it as a bleak day. And that was one of the more temperate comments. Is there anything in that fear, do you think?
I actually don't think that this is the Rubicon that has been described. I think that, in fact, what was interesting was that just there on Monday, we passed into the Enterprise and Regulatory Reform Bill a clause which is called the Entrenchment Clause, which protects this charter from tinkering behind closed doors by members of the Privy Council or by ministers, because it's usually ministers that are members of the Privy Council. And so it's about using the law to protect press freedom. So I don't see it as a Rubicon at all.
One of your colleagues in the House of Lords, Lord Putnam, said this morning that he was quite sanguine about the outcome, but he was troubled by the process because it hadn't taken long enough. Things hadn't been given a decent enough airing. It was done at sort of, 2 a.m., 2:30 in the modern day version of a non-smoke-filled room. Does it trouble you, the process?
I would have liked it to have been much more open. I really would have liked, in the last months since Leveson, that there had been much more of an opportunity for public debate about why this mattered. What's interesting, Steve, is that all the polling before Leveson, during Leveson and since the report came out, all the public polling has shown that the public actually do want something done about the press. They want proper regulation. And so I do think that the press were on a hiding to nothing in thinking that they could, go back to business as usual.
I mean, there is something is sort of slightly unedifying, though, isn't there, about sort of 2 a.m. sort of closed process. I mean, as Simon Jenkins from The Guardian wrote this morning, he said, "Press laws should not be written in the dead of night by a coalition of those worsted by newspapers."
Oh, I love Simon's use of the pen. He's a great journalist.
But he has a point, doesn't he? You had a meeting room full of politicians and four members of Hacked Off, the campaign group that the Media Standards Trust, I think, started in the first place. No editors, no one from the other side, as it were. It is capable of looking like it's pretty one-sided.
And what we also don't know is the extent to which there have been those meetings with Murdoch and with Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail.
We know they weren't there that night.
Yeah, they might not have been there that night, but they've been certainly having plenty of meetings up until now. So there's been a lot of this kind of stuff going on. And I regret that there hasn't been much more that's been in the public domain. But getting consensus of this kind almost inevitably happens behind closed doors. And you need to have people there who do really understand the small print. So, I mean, it's people who feel romantic about the old days of good government forget that this is how lots of decisions have been made in the past. And while I prefer greater transparency, it doesn't come as a surprise to me that this is the only way that they could work to get something out of all three parties. And let's not forget, it was absolutely important for the Prime Minister not to lose this vote, as he was likely to do if it went before the House on Monday. And so getting consensus was very important to hold the coalition together. So politics plays its part in all of this.
So you don't think that in order to get the deal, David Cameron did indeed cross the Rubicon? I mean, there is now a piece of statute, although it doesn't use the word press, which underpins the Royal Charter. A lot of people are saying he said, I'm not crossing the Rubicon, and then that's exactly what he did.
Well, I think there has been a significant shift.
It does have statute.
Of course it does. If you don't have an amendment in a bill like the Enterprise and Regulatory Bill that went through on Monday, you don't have that without it being, call it what you like, but it is statute. And we're going to have an amendment in the Crime and Courts Bill, which will give teeth. And it comes out of Leveson, and it's the most important Leveson incentive to good behaviour for the press, which is that there are cost implications if they don't take part in a regulatory body. There are cost implications at the end of cases where they are sued and lose, having behaved in unacceptable ways.
Well, that brings me to the next point, I think, which is, what do you make of the quality and robustness of what's emerged? I ask because obviously you are an eminent lawyer, a QC. Some of your legal colleagues are saying that this is unlikely to pass muster in legal terms, that the exemplary damages clause you just mentioned would almost certainly, so they say, fall were it ever tested against Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights guaranteeing free speech, because the cost of exercising your right, if you get it wrong, is so significant, it would act as a damper on free speech. So other lawyers are saying this is badly drafted and unlikely to pass muster.
Any contracts have the risk always of being interpreted in different ways.
But do you think they have a point? Are exemplary damages potentially difficult at the European... Well, in terms of free speech, there must be an issue there, surely.
Of course, but it's actually the much less important incentive in this whole package than the costs one. But on the exemplary damages issue, I'm perfectly sure that there would be a challenge in the European Court using our human rights commitments.
Which might succeed?
It'd be interesting to see. So I think you're only going to see exemplary damages issued in the most egregious and outrageous and deliberate kinds of case, and the sort of circumstance which I suspect any other court is likely to uphold.
And what about the costs element of it? If you're not a member of a suitably verified self-regulatory body, you could end up carrying costs in cases where you have won. That seems monstrously unfair, at least.
Well, one of the things that we've got to always remember is that one of Leveson's recommendations was that you can set up other regulatory bodies. I mean, it may well be that some of the people who are unhappy with this will come up with something else and will sign into something different.
But to be verified, if it's not verified, if it doesn't comply with the principles evinced in the charter...
You're absolutely right. There has to be a verifier. And if that doesn't meet the standards that they're talking about, then they're likely to have run the risks in relation to costs. And that's the important Leveson incentive. And that's the thing that's going to be...
But it's not fair, is it?
Carrying costs in cases that you've won, but where you've refused to take part in a system which actually is about greater justice overall. And so I think that sometimes, you have to play by the rules. So even in a case where you might have won it, if you are somebody who hasn't been playing by the rules, then there might be good argument for being made for saying you have to carry the can for that. But what I do love about all of this is that is the idea that the Daily Mail, which absolutely hates human rights and the European Court of Human Rights and the Human Rights Act, is getting all excited about using the Human Rights Act itself in order to make some challenges on this.
I think you might find that inconsistency is a basic tenet of press freedom.
It's absolutely, and we shouldn't mock it. But at the same time, I do think this has been an important step forward. I think there's going to have to be a lot of refinement in amendments, both in the Commons and in the Lords, and we'll have to get it right. We really will. And I don't think it's going to be easy, but I do see this as being an important move forward. But I don't think, you know, Simon Jenkins is right in saying this is victim's vengeance. It really isn't.
What about the argument that, and again, Jenkins makes it, but so have many others, he says it's hard to imagine a more chilling deterrent to serious press investigation than this.
No, I mean, there we are.
You don't fear for the...
I mean,
even when you look, for example, at the way that this is supposed to work, with the verification body able to intervene in between inspections, ad hoc inspections, if you like, because some public cause not defined causes them to, it's going to produce, at the very least, second guessing on the part and caution on the part of editors, isn't it?
I think there should be caution. You see, I think that there should be caution and I think that there should be serious discussion, which hasn't been taking place in recent years. Does this pass muster? Is this seriously an issue of public interest, or are we titillating people? And I think that those discussions in editorial rooms have become flabby, and I think that this will actually sharpen up those discussions. So I'm not fearful in that way.
Helena Kennedy, QC. Well, now, before we get to our panel, I'm joined down the line from Wapping by Times chief leader writer and one-time Tony Blair speechwriter, I read, Philip Collins. Many thanks indeed for joining us, Philip.
You're welcome.
What do you make of Helena Kennedy? She says this is a move forward and it's not a threat. Do you accept that?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of threads hanging on this piece. I have a great deal of respect for Helena Kennedy, and I didn't think I'd come on and dispute her understanding of the law, but I thought the answer to your question about carrying costs when you've won a case was really rather extraordinary. She sort of conceded that it was unjust, but there's a greater good which it must serve. I think that's a basic unfairness. I think there's a whole series of practical problems with the deal as has been done. And I think those, in addition to the philosophical question, are going to cause real difficulty for the press in accepting this as a basis to move on.
Do you accept her point that the bit of statute that prevents the charter from being changed by the Privy Council is in fact a protection for the press and not the opposite?
I'm not sure that's right. I think there's probably two motivations for that two-thirds majority in both houses that is required to change it, and different people have different motivations. The first is some people will see it as a protection of the press. They think that ministers might tamper with the charter, although this doesn't seem to happen with any other charter, so why ministers would, I don't know. But then there's also those people who actually see this as a bulwark against the press, using their power, as they see it, against Parliament to get the charter changed.
But either way, you might regard it as quite a good thing.
Well, I think it depends what you're locking in, because if they're going to lock in a deal which has been hastily drawn and ill-conceived, then they're simply locking down a system that's really not fit for purpose. So it depends. It goes back to the prior question of whether you think this is a good deal or not.
Well, on that question, Lord Hunt, and as you know, and Lord Black from The Telegraph and others have been involved in putting together proposals for a new self-regulator. And as far as I can see, and I went to a couple of briefings that he held, in terms of the practicalities, £1 million fines, the power to investigate, enforcing corrections and all this sort of stuff, all of those things are part of the self-regulatory system that Lords Hunt and Black are putting together anyway. I wonder if there is any really significant distinction between what the Charter contains by way of the verification principles and what the press is talking about doing for itself.
I think you're right up to a point, and that's why it's not true to say, as Helena Kennedy did, that the press wants business as usual. It clearly doesn't. There's clearly been an acceptance of a new regime, and there is some overlap between the self-regulatory system advocated and the one which is on the table here.
They're very similar, in fact.
They're similar up to a point, but there are some significant differences. The first difference is a matter of principle. It was David Cameron who introduced the metaphor of the crossing the Rubicon, and he defined the Rubicon as statute. And there's no question this is a statutory system. So if that's the Rubicon, and if that's important, if that's an important principle, it has been crossed.
Although, isn't the point there that a press law, once you have a press law, his argument was, well, the temptation to come back and amend it is almost irresistible, and even if you never do amend it, you've changed the balance of power between a free press and the people they're supposed to be keeping an eye on, having given, if you like, the sword of Damocles to the politicians to swing, forgive the metaphor, to swing whenever it suits them. It's inconceivable, isn't it, that this particular bit of statute could be used for that purpose?
I think that's right. I think a royal charter backed by statute is different from a fully fledged press law. There's no question about that. I think David Cameron won that argument. It's still a statute, and if you think that the realms of the press and the realms of the state should be kept separate as a matter of principle, as embodied in the First Amendment to the American Constitution, for example, then that Rubicon has been crossed. But I think that the things that will really be difficult in this deal are actually the practical questions. I know from time in government that the thing that you really struggle with when you're trying to define a piece of law is all the unintended consequences, all the things you don't mean to do that you end up doing in drafting something. And I think the two significant differences between the deal on the table here and what the Lord Black has suggested are the things you picked up in your interview with Helena Kennedy. The question of exemplary damages, for example, whether that, as drafted, is in fact legal, it will certainly be subject to legal challenge, is a very serious question that we need to know the answer to. And the arbitration system, the free arbitration, there's a serious risk that leads to a whole host of frivolous claims. And then the idea that you carry costs in cases you've won, as I said before, is something which seems like a basic unfairness. So there's a series of practical problems. The final one of which is somebody at the last minute thought, oh, what should we do about the internet? Shall we include the internet? Yes, why not? Let's have the internet included. Even though it was the major criticism of Leveson that it didn't go anywhere near the internet and therefore was regulating for the last scandal rather than the next one. So you've got now this peculiar thing where we've travelled all the way from a scandal about phone hacking to discussing whether Mumsnet are going to be included in the system.
We'll come back to the internet with our panel discussion a little later, but just let me ask you one more question, if I may. And I know that you don't speak for News International, The Times, or anyone other than yourself. If you had to decide whether to join into this scheme or not, what would you do?
My own view, and it is very much a personal view, because
sure.
I'm sure when News International tell you what they've decided to do, then you'll ring me and let me know. My own
you'll
view,
hear it here first.
I'm sure I will. My own view is that if there were a way of getting to the bottom of those practical problems that I have identified and ensuring that they weren't going to cause serious problems, then I could personally live with the Royal Charter and the statute as it's embodied. But the practical problems are very severe and they need to be fixed and time is short.
OK. Philip Collins, many thanks indeed. And if you've thoughts about anything you hear in the programme, by all means email us via the website. And if you use Twitter, it's hashtag, R4 Media Show. So now to our panel, Professor Natalie Fenton of Goldsmiths College and Hacked Off, Peter Preston of The Observer and Chris Blackhurst, editor of The Independent. Many thanks all for joining us. Natalie, what is your reaction to Philip? I mean, is this settlement what you wanted?
No. If you go back, we thought, you know, the actual Leveson report itself was something of a compromise from where we started. So this isn't a hacked off charter. We should get rid of that idea altogether. But
although hacked off, they were there at the end, they were there at the beginning, they've played a pretty significant role in it.
But there's been 3 months in between where actually we haven't had an awful lot of negotiating power, and many people in the press industry have been in and out of Downing Street very regularly. So it's been a political process, and I do agree with both Philip and Helena on that. And we're willing to accept that this is where we've got to. And we should all now get behind it.
Do you think there are any significant press freedom issues sitting in here? As Philip said, that these will be they'll almost certainly be unintended consequences, but nevertheless consequences they are.
At some point, you have to bite the bullet, and you have to actually say we need to do something, and we need to get on with it. Unintended consequences we could go on arguing about forever, and there will be things that may need changing as you go through it. But it's one legal opinion will battle against another.
The industry, I should say, are not speaking at the moment. All they've said when they've come together is that they are taking high-level legal advice. But Chris Blackhurst, you are a member of the industry. Last week on this programme, before this deal, you said that you were sort of broadly in favour of being in the system, imperfect as it was. What's your view now?
It's not changed. I wouldn't say that I'm embracing it. I'm not sort of. It's not something I'm in love with. It's, as I've said, it's by no means perfect. You know, there are practical problems with it. I'm hoping they can be resolved. I'm hoping that when we get down to it, that the actual regulator will have the ability to apply regulation properly and reasonably, and change things. What I'm not doing, though, is indulging in the sort of over-hysterical reaction of others.
Do you think that they are literally practical difficulties which can be resolved in negotiation, or are they more serious? For example, if the exemplary damages idea that people who are not part of a validated self-regulator would be exposed to exemplary damages in libel and privacy cases, that they might be exposed to carrying costs in cases where they'd won, in other words, there were significant financial incentives, that doesn't sound like a drafting error. That sounds like that's the intention.
It does, and that actually is the one you've picked. You've picked the one that I think is probably of the problems is the one that's the most legal, and I think that there is an issue in law.
I mean, they've already passed that law.
I'm not sure if it would stand up to the human rights or whatever. I mean, I think it's pretty unfair to be charging exemplary damages, and was pointed out earlier, to actually win a case and then have costs awarded against you is
pretty perverse. Do you think this is negotiable?
That is a grey area. I know it sounds odd that I'm sort of prepared to try something without knowing if it's negotiable. I'm assuming it is. I may be wrong in that assumption.
And if it wasn't, would that cause you to change your view of the scheme?
The exemplary is a problem. I'm not happy about that. I mean, the other thing I'm not happy about is the arbitration system, although I think that can be... I think a filter can be applied on that.
All right. Peter Preston, you're no longer a serving editor, but what do you make of what's emerged? Is this workable?
At the moment, no. And I think you only listened to Elena Kennedy and to Chris. Chris is the most vibrantly pro signing up of all the national editors.
Sure,
in fact, he's the only one who's
Alan,
even vaguely pro in terms of anything that has been said on the record so far. We know one or two magazines which aren't going to be part of it. Everybody else is sucking their thumb. I think it's quite likely that much will rest on what Helena Kennedy was talking about. She doesn't know which way all of the legal arguments will go. She doesn't know how long they'll take. Nobody wants to sign up to a compendious agreement which may fracture the moment Strasbourg coughs. You have to be careful about this. And to say, well, we've been hanging around for a long time, but at 2 o'clock on a morning, we agreed something which MPs didn't have a chance to read and now we must plough on, is a pretty doff argument.
Can I say something there? I think, Peter, if you look at our editorial and look at the Guardian editorial and look at the Financial Times editorial, you'll find they're pretty much word for word the same. And to say that I'm the only editor... that's just plain wrong. I mean, Alan Rusbridge is away in India at the moment, but I know that he shares exactly the same view.
All I saw from Alan was the last thing was the headline where he said he had grave reservations.
Well, I have reservations too.
Okay. Well, he has grave reservations. Well, okay.
I think in fairness, you say Lionel Barber also says that he has not yet made up his mind.
And on the Today programme was pretty critical.
But let's just move on. Natalie, the internet has popped up here. It's popped up in Schedule 4 interpretation, where any website containing news-related material, whether or not related to a newspaper or magazine, is included. In other words, anybody doing that, which sounds like it could be anyone on Twitter for that, if you like, is now covered by this. Was that ever your intention?
It was certainly never our intention, no. So, I mean, this is something that I think needs to be ironed out very quickly in the Charter, and I think it will be. We've had announcements from Maria Miller already that actually it's not the intention that bloggers and those on Twitter and people doing a sort of individual news output, if you like, will be covered by this, not remotely.
Well, OK, but just take a slightly broader view. You could argue that the criticism of Leveson, that ignoring the internet, essentially what he did, was a very serious criticism, and that actually, you know, we're learning about really important events. People are having their life turned upside down because of what someone starts putting on Twitter, and which eventually finds its way around. And sometimes the press, even on their own websites, are kind of quite late in the process.
But there's a very real distinction between who is getting access to... We still know that the majority of people actually get their news from things like the television and from newspapers, actually.
So, but the world is changing, though.
The world is changing, and law will have to change to keep up with that. But I still think there's... You have to make a distinction between a news organisation who is, producing for, very many thousands of people at profit... from a sole blogger in his room who may occasionally hit lucky, but very rarely.
Right. Just let me ask you another question then. It's pretty clear from what's being written at the moment that the press, significant parts of the press, are considering it. Even Lionel Barber at the FT says he hasn't decided whether to join or not. Chris, I think, is the only one who said, well, they probably will, but who knows? The point is they're currently considering their position. What happens here if a significant number of them say, we'll take our chances with exemplary damages, we're not doing it?
That's the chance they will have to take. I think that would be a crying shame and a possible public relations disaster for lots of newspapers. And we also know that the majority of the public think that something serious should be done.
I mean, one of your colleagues, Brian Cathcart from Hacktoff, said that perhaps Parliament or the government should set up their own temporary regulator to sort it, to look after it while the press gets their act together.
Well, if the...
Would you go along with that?
If the current regulatory body fails and the recognition process fails, in other words, not enough sign up to it, that would be a mark of failure, then that the self-regulatory body has to report that back to Parliament. That's in the charter.
But this is going a huge step further, isn't it? Would you tolerate Parliament or government setting up their own regulator if the press can't get it together?
If the press can't get it together, something will have to be done.
Peter?
I think we've got many rivers to flow under many bridges here, and we need to be pretty calm about it. But I do think unless there is a real sea change, bearing in mind, people keep saying, why do the repeated efforts to reform the press keep failing? It's because we have a habit of having a report commissioned, the government of the day decides upon it, and it's not negotiated. Really, Sir Miliband citing Ireland yet again, and the plain fact, it took the Irish government, not a report, four years to negotiate that system, okay. And we haven't had that negotiation.
All right, well, I'm sure we'll come back to this. Natalie Fenton, Chris Blackhurst, Peter Preston, many thanks. And just before we go, you might remember an item from last week's programme about DFL. That was a Times back page splash scoop saying that the Qatari royal family were about to start something called Dream Football League. Top world clubs would receive $170 million a year plus to play. A French soccer website popped up to say the story was a hoax. The chap from the Times, Oliver Kay, told us here that definitely wasn't true and his story most definitely was. Oh dear. This week, the Times admitted it had made, and I quote, a massive mistake, because, and there's no suggestion at all that the writer knew this, it was indeed a hoax, albeit an elaborate one. And all I'll say is that there'll be journalists up and down the land muttering, there but for the grace of you-know-who. Well, that is all we have time for this week. As ever, do feel free to get in touch through the website, where you can email us or download a copy of the programme. And if you use Twitter, you can join the conversation, as they say, about anything in today's programme using the hashtag R4MediaShow. So thanks for listening, and do join us again next week. Same time, same place.
Thank you for downloading the Media Show podcast from BBC Radio 4. The presenter was Steve Hewlett and the producer, Simon Tillotson. For more information, please go to our website, bbc.co.uk/radio4/mediashow.